everybody have reports for our late start, but we had a long session this morning, and therefore everything got pushed back, as well as had a lunch with UW Whitewater students, who pre-law students who come with us often. We have today, for this argument, the youth in government, and from the YMCA. And would those students please stand? And are you all with the Supreme Court division of that youth and government? Oh, is that who you swore in? Justice Wilcox swore you in at 1 o'clock or thereabouts today, and you will be in these chambers on the weekend. Is that right? Good. Well, thank you all for coming, and won't you all be seated? I should introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice David Prosser, and seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, whom you've met, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. We're proceeding with our third case today, 00-0640-J, in the matter of judicial disciplinary proceedings against the Honorable Robert Crawford, Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge, Wisconsin Judicial Commission versus the Honorable Robert Crawford. I have, arguing on behalf of the Honorable Robert Crawford, Thomas J. Crawford. Mr. Crawford, I assume that the reference to the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewers District is for identification only and that you're not appearing on behalf of the district. Is that right?
That's right, Judge. Apparently your clerks must have dug that up because that is my day job, but I'm doing this pro bono and I'm on vacation today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Crawford. Seated with me is Mark Hirsch. We represent Judge Robert Crawford, who is seated in the front row here today. I'm going to answer the three questions that you always ask when I listen to your oral argument over the internet. What is the black letter rule of law for this case? End the platitude that judges should remain silent. Elected judges have the same right to speak publicly on matters of judicial administration and justice, courthouse politics, as other citizens, so long as they are not speaking about pending cases or private parties, where the risk and evil of bias, the appearance of bias, the impartiality is the greatest. We sacrifice too much in attempts to preserve the rule of judicial silence. More is to be gained for the judiciary by engaging in vigorous public debate in our democracy. The benefits of openness far outweigh the cost of silence and the gag order. If a judge abuses his or her discretion when speaking about matters of judicial administration or courthouse politics on occasion, so be it. The Republic will survive. What is the standard of review in this case? Review is de novo, meaning anew or fresh, an independent examination of the whole record to ensure that the discipline does not constitute a forbidden intrusion on protected expressive rights. The important thing here is the context, and context, context, context. The context here is a petition, which is highly critical of the administration of justice in Milwaukee County Circuit Court and was properly and publicly directed to this court pursuant to the rules dealing with the authority of the Chief Judge to make rules. The evidence here consists of constitutional facts. That is, publicly expressed opinions about matters of public concern by public figures as office holders. And it is a question of law as to whether any particular statement is susceptible of an interpretation that implies a false assertion of fact. The discipline before you asks this court to censor political speech. And finally, you should put state law first here. The state constitution, the Wisconsin Constitution, provides more protection for the right to petition government from redress of grievances than its federal counterpart. And the Wisconsin Constitution, Article 1, Section 3, provides more protected free speech for elected judges than the federal minimum. And the federal minimum doesn't care about elected judges. It is the state courts and the state court opinions that we have provided you that put the particular emphasis on the reality that the judges are political figures in a political process and that their bosses are the ones at the ballot boxes. This is finally a case of original jurisdiction. The discipline is what we call one of those sui generis proceedings, which means that it's unique or peculiar. Peculiar, I suppose, in the sense that it explains why you don't have a record in front of you under 80915 that indexes everything that's gone on before.
Mr. Crawford, as I understand the standard of review, we would review findings of fact to determine whether they're clearly erroneous, but that the determination of whether these facts would violate the code would be a question of law that we would decide de novo, and that if there were to be discipline, that would be our determination, irrespective of any recommendation by the referee or the Judicial Commission or yourself. Now, do I have that wrong?
You have the last part right.
Okay. One-third isn't bad.
And I'll go through the first part. The last part you have right. There is no final order or mandate that has been appealed from here. There's nothing but a recommendation. Only the Supreme Court, under the Constitution, can use the relatively newly created provision, the alternative to impeachment, to remove a judge or take a judge out of office for so much as a day for what the legislature and the court has defined as misconduct for the Code of Ethics. Your statement of the standard of review, the clearly erroneous, is fine for the run-of-the-mill judicial discipline case where it is a matter of facts that don't have a constitutional gloss. What you have here is a set of facts that are 100% with a constitutional gloss. There's no conduct here. You typically are dealing with a disciplinary case where a judge is engaged in inappropriate conduct with a woman in an elevator. And your question of whether that's a willful touching or fondling goes to whether it was an accidental brushing up against somebody. Willfulness, as you have it in the definition of misconduct, does not begin to appropriate to reach the higher standard necessary for criminalization or punishment arising from pure speech. What Judge Crawford did here was open his mouth and unleash his pen, or more appropriately, his word processor.
Counsel, in that area, and I know we have extensive briefs here, and I'm sure we've all been over them several times. But in a nutshell, because this is a review of the facts, we're looking, just can you spend a moment or two on just your position on, I understand it on free speech, but just exactly what happened here according to your client. What is your version?
Judge Crawford was a freshman judge who brought a very unique work ethic. He is the most extreme case of a type A personality in terms of his work ethic and his devotion. His courtroom, in an effort to process cases was recording some of the higher overtime rates compared to the other municipal courts. Now, I say higher, but it's not by much. What you have in the record is a memorandum that compares Branch 9 to the other courts, and I think Judge Crawford was at 21%, a nearby court was at 19% of the overtime. Those are relative, and another one was just right behind it, relatively small differences. So Judge Crawford, as you all remember Judge Sheehy, he's a fellow well met. He came to see Judge Crawford on more than one occasion and put his arm around his shoulder and said, "Son, you're working too hard. I want you to slow down." Eventually, Judge Crawford got the message. Judge Sheehy memorialized that in a memo to Judge Crawford, saying, "Thou shalt not work extended hours." The key phrase there is extended hours. A short time, a year or two later, there was a rotation in the court. Judge Skorowski became the chief judge. Judge Skorowski was at the time, his daughter was living at home. She was the prosecutor for 6 weeks in Judge Crawford's court. She was working long hours. She would get out of Judge Crawford's court at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the evening. She'd go to her office for an hour or two. Her dad would then come and pick her up. She was living at home. She didn't have a car. On the way home, she'd grouse about how hard Judge Crawford was working her. And they talk about, wouldn't it be nice to run against him? And this is part of the transcript. She admitted that she was talking with her dad, the chief judge, about running against Judge Crawford. So the animosity that Judge Crawford says was motivating the continuation of this stop work order is in the record.
Although, is that a finding?
No, I'm afraid the judicial panel was not interested in sharing that information with you. It's not. There's not a word. It is just blocked out of the findings.
What you told us is clearly in the record, in the transcript. What you just said was in.
It's all in the record.
Okay.
I'm not making it up.
No finding.
Mr. Crawford, I'd like to ask a question. When we're talking about extended hours, is there anything in the record that would indicate what types of situations were causing extended hours? Are we talking about jury deliberations? Are we talking about trials to the court? What are we talking about that would translate into the extended hours?
Yes, Judge, you do have in the record in what is called Volume 2 of the exhibits filed by Judge Crawford in support of his motion to dismiss, which was converted to a motion for summary judgment, which was denied. You do have in there 50 or 60 pages, beginning at page 5,156, which were the emails that Judge Crawford sent Judge Skorowski over the 13 months after Judge Skorowski imposed his order, which said, don't work past noon and don't work past 5 o'clock without my permission. You have there about 50 to 60 emails, which represent every single instance that Judge Crawford worked beyond noon or 5 o'clock during that 13-month period. You have Judge Crawford's explanation for why he thought it was important in the interest of justice for him to finish what he was working on. And you will see that Judge Skorowski granted him permission to do so in every instance until, as sort of a passive-aggressive reaction, he stopped talking to him. Judge Crawford asked permission every single time.
The discipline that's being recommended in this case doesn't have to do with Judge Crawford's work hours. So I would like to focus on the discipline that's the gravamen of the alleged misconduct in this case, which is the allegations that the commission found were false about which Judge Crawford said he would go public in the meeting that occurred in the Chief Judge's office, and those also to the extent that they are contained in the petition to this court. So if you would focus on those, because Judge Crawford is not being disciplined here for working too hard, or the suggestion is not that we discipline Judge Crawford for working too hard. The suggestion is that we should discipline him for the allegedly false allegations that were made in that meeting and in the petition. Or at least that's how I understand this case.
Well, maybe I could jump in on the same issue and just get some clarification. It's my understanding that the panel was finding that indeed Judge Crawford disobeyed the order of Judge Sheedy and disobeyed the order of Judge Skorowski. Am I wrong in that regard?
You're absolutely right, and that was where they falsely built their claim that Judge Crawford was somehow not credible. They ignored what was in the record. They didn't tell you about it. They didn't weigh it and balance it. They didn't tell you how they got to the conclusion that Judge Crawford was violating any of the stop work orders. They can't tell you which day of the week. They can't give you which day of the month. They can't point to a single instance. What they point to are two memorandum that were solicited to punish Judge Crawford, which attempt to draw an inference between summaries of overtime by clerks and bailiffs, and the inference is that that had to have been on the record proceedings in Judge Crawford's court. As Judge Crawford has said, Judge Crawford has explained repeatedly in his affidavit in support of his motion, in his testimony before the Judicial Council, and at trial, that the bailiffs have a lot of work to do in taking people away after the court has closed up at 5 o'clock, that Judge Crawford does hold pre-trial deliberations just with the attorneys in chambers after 5 o'clock. Those are off the record. They don't need a court reporter, and there isn't a court clerk there. However, during this exact same period where this overtime was being accumulated, most of it was due to the court computer administration update, where these clerks had to sit, not just do the 8 hours worth of on-the-record work in Judge Crawford's courtroom, but this is the exact time frame that they were all, and this is universal throughout the circuit courts in Milwaukee County, although Judge Crawford's might have been hit a little bit more because they didn't have as much free time during the regular 8-hour day to catch up with the circuit court automation program. But let me go back to Justice Sykes's question, if I may. You had suggested that the seven assertions here. And let me break this down. First of all, you've got two things that this discipline's all about. Number one is the extortion charge. Now, I think we dealt with the extortion charge in the brief. Unless you have specific questions about it, that's obviously a red herring. It's outrageous that somebody at this point in life, at this day and age, would be prosecuted for making the kind of everyday threats that we have a right to make in our daily practice of law and in our individual situation, which is, if you don't give me what I believe I have is right, I will go public and I will tell on you. And I will tell on you in a public arena where the social criticism will embarrass you, because you will be embarrassed for withholding my rent or whatever it was, which I believe is mine, that you should give me. So extortion is dead in terms of the claim here. I think legally, there's no way that holds up. So let me go to the remaining points. Would be that Judge Crawford is guilty of seven assertions of false fact. Now, we struggle with an artificial dichotomy when we're dealing with freedoms of expression, when we attempt to separate fact from opinion. Judge Crawford's, the seven particular elements that they picked out as false facts are not facts. None of them are factual in nature. Let me read to you one of them that you would not glean from the judicial panel's decision involved statements of fact. It is their reference to judges treating Friday afternoons like a perpetual holiday, and they treated that as a false statement of fact. Now, actually, if you read Judge Crawford's petition, he has a pretty good sense of humor. And on page 3, and this is in the first volume of Judge Crawford's motion to dismiss, page 5048, he says, rather than restricting hardworking judges, the chief judge should enter orders of court operation that, one, bar judges from turning lunchroom breaks into mini vacations, two, require that judges begin court at the hours published on the calendar rather than when the judge arrives at the courthouse in the morning or after an extended lunch hour. And three, prohibit judges from treating Friday afternoons like a perpetual state holiday. Now, this is sarcasm. This is taunting. But this is not a statement of fact. He says, if you want to make the judicial administration more efficient, then these are the kinds of abuses that you might want to address as a chief judge. He didn't accuse anybody of this. He didn't say anybody was guilty of it. He didn't give a single instance of it.
No, but isn't the inference that it's a general practice?
It's Judge Crawford's opinion.
Okay.
And his opinion can be wrong, it can be disagreeable, but it's not false.
Well, counsel, you may be right with respect to finding number 47, but what about his assertion that that, for instance, Audrey Swarovski had drafted, signed, and filed a criminal complaint that she knew was materially false? Or his assertion that Bruce Harvey tried to influence his rulings. Those are statements of fact. Also that Bruce Harvey used his administrative office to peddle influence with the Milwaukee District Attorney. That's a statement of fact. When he says that Audrey Swarovski was unable to keep up with her workload, that's a statement of fact, and each and every one, the panel said that those assertions were false. How do you respond to that?
Judge Crawford testified that Audrey Swarovski came into his courtroom after hours prior to her leaving, put her head down on her desk, said, "I can't keep up with the workload." Now, that's the testimony.
Did she admit to that?
She denied it. So Judge Crawford said it happened in my courtroom. That's where I got the idea from. Okay. That is his opinion. That's his subjective opinion.
Okay.
What
about the Freddie Lewis case?
On the Freddie Lewis case, it may be true that there was not a violation of the professional standard that is applicable to prosecutors under the code. But it is certainly true that as a matter of justice, this young black man was overcharged. Because during my day job, one of the things I do is look up criminal complaints of people who are confessing to them during the hiring process. And we get the complaint and we get the police reports. And when I read in a police report or a criminal complaint that the defendant was guilty of disorderly conduct or plea bargained to some fourth-degree sexual assault, but the true facts were that he held his mother and his family hostage, in this case, took his girlfriend hostage, at gunpoint and violently raped her. We don't want that kind of person working for us with that kind of violent tendency, but somebody who simply had underage sex, well, that would hardly disqualify you from working at the sewage district. That's the kind of justice, Your Honor. And when we talk about what the ethical responsibilities are of the prosecutor, one of the things is to be fair and to be just. Now, apparently the explanation the judicial panel accepts here is that it's a common practice for prosecutors to put information that they know is false into a criminal complaint in the guise of a pre-sentence report, I guess, so that they show the judge both sides of the story.
But counsel, the panel said, quote, "No facts alleged in the criminal complaint are false, and that Audrey Swarovski's decision to charge Lewis was reasonable under the circumstances."
Oh, Judge,
how can we overturn
the panel? The panel is misleading you. And what I would ask you to do is Judge Crawford has the entire transcript of that sentencing proceeding as part of his exhibits, which are being ignored. I mean, he has been railroaded here, and so it isn't odd that the facts would reflect that bias in their cherry-picking and choosing.
Well, then your position is, if I understand it, that the facts as found by this panel do not have sufficient basis in the record, and that if we were reasonable and went through the record, we would conclude otherwise. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Absolutely. Those are my words. Those are my words, Your Honor. And I would go further and remind you that even if you take the debatable parts or the phasey, subjective, interpretive parts of Judge Crawford's words, there is no actual harm ultimately. Empirically, there is no harm, and there is no proof of harm, that judicial integrity is harmed in the least. And our argument is that as a matter of constitutional law and as a matter of empirical truth, that the judiciary serves itself best when it does engage in some soul-searching and public debate about the way the courthouse is operated, and that that's good, and that that makes the that gives the public trust, and that the public sees that you have a process here. And by the way, this process works. Judge Skorowski's repealed his order. As of July 1st, 2001, by email, Judge Crawford isn't under a stop work order. So you see, we've already made improvements. The other thing is, we don't have problems in Judge Crawford's courtroom with the district attorney's not keeping up now, because every time there's criticism, they change. And they now had, when he was still in misdemeanor court, three assistant district attorneys were necessary to handle the load. And that's the way the assignment should have been in the first place, so that they didn't interfere with the judge's ability to prosecute cases.
Mr. Crawford, I agree with you that there should be open public discussion about how courts are run. They're run for the people. The people have a right to know, and the people have a right to criticize. And judges have not only a right, a responsibility to improve the administration of justice. But the conclusion here is that there have been unfounded allegations about the administration of justice and misrepresenting what are the facts about the administration of justice clearly doesn't promote public confidence in the integrity and impartiality of the judiciary. How do you respond to that?
A judge, as an elected office holder who is engaged in public and open debate, has the same right and the same protection to be wrong as any other elected official or office holder. In other words, under the First Amendment standard of New York Times versus Sullivan, every elected judge and every elected office holder, even every public figure, has a right to speak out with the knowledge that even if they're wrong on some facts, they will not be held legally responsible. Do you want me to continue?
Yeah, I do.
They will not be held legally responsible unless the standard of subjective actual malice is met, which is the New York Times standard. And that says that Judge Crawford, in good faith, actually good faith isn't part of it, but in this case it was in good faith because he sincerely believes what he said in his petition, that unless the person actually knew, basically an ostrich that sticks their head in the sand, and refuses, they knew that the facts were false and yet they alleged them anyway. And when you look at the seminal cases that the Supreme Court has decided, people are not convicted of subjective actual malice for sloppy journalism, for failure to undertake a more aggressive investigation or interview a few more witnesses before they express their opinion. And that is the protection that Judge Crawford and all of you have, and you have to have it, because you're elected politicians in a democratic system where you have to be free to speak out without worrying about somebody coming back with either a criminal sanction, an ethical sanction, or a private lawsuit to hold you accountable for some mistake.
Mr. Crawford, Justice Crooks has a question.
Even though we're beyond the red light, I'd like to ask you, do you take the position that a judge maintains the full First Amendment rights, or do you recognize that there are restrictions once you take the office of judge?
I recognize that there are significant restrictions that you necessarily give up, but the question is, why do you give them up? Is the restriction of speech narrowly tailored, and for what purpose? The empirical purpose that speech is narrowly tailored and restricted for those who wear the robes is because it is often necessary to restrict judicial or bar speech for people to get a fair trial, for people to have assurances that a judge is not biased as a case is pending before them, or as it may come back to them and they're complaining about some mistake made by the Court of Appeals. So you do have an area of on the bench, on the record, dealing directly with parties or classes of parties where it is important that a judge be silent most of the time and keep their opinions to themselves. However, when you're on the campaign trail, and certainly a six-year term is no sabbatical, when you're dealing with courthouse politics, you're arguing over whether the judges have adequate parking spaces, or maybe something more profound, such as Judge Crawford got involved with, where he's being disciplined for working. Those are matters of judicial administration. There are no private parties involved in those. Those are about institutions. Those are about correcting and changing an institution which has a quirk or needs some updating, some improvement, some refining, some challenging. Those are areas where there's no justification to restrict a judge's speech any more than any other citizen's, because it doesn't look bad for the judiciary, and it builds faith. And I know you're extremely busy, but every law review article that we cited in our brief is written by a judge arguing that judicial speech is good for the institutions, whether they're writing as a lifetime tenured judge, a federal judge, or whether they're in a little bit hotter seat as an elected trial judge in one of the states. And I would urge you to look at what the other judges are saying about the trend that the judicial code of silence, the universal code of silence, is not healthy for the judiciary as a whole and should be narrowly tailored.
Chief, could I follow up? I'm sorry to prolong this. I would like to go back to one question before that and have you apply the actual Malice New York Times versus Sullivan test to the Freddie Lewis case allegation here.
Very simple. All you have to do is read Judge Crawford's on-the-record transcript of the sentencing where he examined the district attorneys over why the complaint said one thing but the facts were the other. He had the detective testify, and the detective who did the investigation said he told the assistant district attorney that the young girl was lying about her story of being kidnapped at gunpoint and raped, that they were boyfriend-girlfriend and they were skipping school and doing what teenagers do when they skip school, very consensually over the course of a day. So Judge Crawford sincerely believes, and he'd pass a lie detector test now if you gave it to him, that was an overcharging of a black man, of a young black man, that seriously, and that the DA knew that those were not the facts, that all you had here was illegal underage sex. You didn't have any violence involved.
It's one thing to accuse a prosecutor of discretionarily overcharging a case. It's another thing to accuse a prosecutor of filing a false complaint, which is what I understand Judge Crawford did in this case. And that's what he says in the petition anyway. Those are two different things. I mean, all of us have had differences of opinion with prosecutors on the bench and have said, I think you overcharged this case. But that's something entirely different from accusing a prosecutor of filing a false complaint. Is the police report in the file?
No, it is not. But you have in the file, in the transcript of the sentencing proceeding, which was adjourned and carried on after lunch. You have an absolutely exhaustive discussion of what evidence the district attorney did and did not have at the time the charge was made. What Judge Crawford is saying is that it was a material false statement to have the paragraph in the complaint about the violent abduction at gunpoint from a bus stop and the forcible rape when none of that happened, and they knew, the prosecutor knew, none of that happened when that complaint was drafted. So the material false part of Justice Sykes is not the ultimate charging decision, which was the fourth degree sexual assault, which would appear to be a gross undercharge for the facts in the first paragraph of the complaint.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Crawford. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Basting, representing the Wisconsin Judicial Commission.
May it please the court, my name is Thomas J. Basting, Sr., with the firm of Brennan Stile, Basting, and McDougall, and I represent the Wisconsin Judicial Commission in these proceedings. With me at council table is Mr. James Alexander, who is the executive director of the Judicial Commission. Let me begin with by saying, first of all, that the commission wants us all to remember that there are some other real people who are involved with this case. And we shouldn't forget them when we talk about the facts that led up to the Judicial Conduct Panel's recommendation and findings. And those people are Chief Judge Michael Skorowski, District Court Administrator Bruce Harvey, Audrey Skorowski, the daughter of Chief Judge Michael Skorowski, District Attorney Michael McCann of Milwaukee County, numerous other assistant district attorneys, and Nancy Ettenheim, whose name appears in these proceedings. These are the people whose names were publicly held up to ridicule by the respondent in this case. The respondents have not challenged the 53 findings of fact which were made by the Judicial Conduct Panel. And we submit that this court, therefore, using the appropriate standard of review, because those were not challenged in any way in the respondent's brief, should find and accept those findings as true in this case, including the finding by the Judicial Conduct Panel that Judge Crawford was not a credible witness.
Counsel, this court is, although there may be nothing in the brief that overtly and succinctly states we challenge the findings of fact, as I heard the argument right before you, seemed to me they were challenging some of the relevant findings of fact.
Justice Bradley, I heard that argument for the first time today here, that they are now saying that counsel said, at least alluded in response to some questions, that they were challenging certain findings of fact. My point is that without addressing those in the brief to this court and saying finding number 46 is incorrect because, and it should have been, the true correct finding should have been, without doing that, what the respondent really has done here is to waive the right to challenge those findings. That is our position. Obviously, on the credibility issue, this court would defer to the Judicial Conduct Panel, I would hope, on the finding that Judge Crawford was not, during the entire course of this four-day trial, a credible witness. Utilizing the findings that the Judicial Conduct Panel has made, the appropriate analysis then is to determine whether or not, using those findings, Judge Crawford has violated the rules of judicial conduct. More appropriately, the rule under 60.031, which requires judges to act at all times in a manner that promotes public confidence in the integrity and impartiality of the judiciary.
Now, suppose there was something the matter with the administration of justice in a county. And if this was revealed, certainly would not promote public confidence. But if the allegations were true, don't you think that a judge should so state? Because in the long run, it does promote confidence if we repair our own house, if it's to be repaired.
I agree that if a judge speaks out as to problems within the judicial system and makes accusations of fact that are true, that a judge obviously perhaps not only has the right to do that, but may have a duty to do that. But that isn't what happened here. What happened here when you asked counsel to review the facts in this case, that one of the questions was that led up to what occurred here. Chief Judge Sheedy issued an order to Judge Crawford regulating his work hours in his courtroom. Judge Crawford did not object to that. He complied with it, as a matter of fact, although there is evidence in the record that he was not necessarily complying with the original Sheedy order. When Judge Sheedy was replaced by Chief Judge Skarowski, Chief Judge Skarowski then issued his order, which really was pretty much a template, a repeat of the Sheedy order, regulating Judge Crawford's hours. Now, obviously, Judge Crawford at that time had a right to file a petition with this court and to say, I want you to review that order because I don't think it's appropriate, period. But that isn't what he did. He didn't stop there. He filed a petition with this court where he made reckless public accusations attacking the conduct of other public officials, Chief Judge Skarowski, his daughter. And I can go through those, and I'm glad we talked about the issue involving Audrey Skarowski in the filing of the Freddie Lewis complaint, because I think, as District Attorney McCann testified in this case, that was absolutely outrageous what Judge Crawford did concerning that issue. What happened there was that he sent a memo to District Attorney McCann saying, one of your employees, Audrey Skarowski, has falsely, improperly filed a criminal complaint in my court that she knew was false. District Attorney McCann testified when he got that, he was absolutely horrified. He testified, as a matter of fact, I believe that he offered to file a complaint with the Judicial Commission at that point because of what happened. The findings here by the Judicial Conduct Panel were that under those circumstances, what Judge Crawford should have done, what the rules required him to do, is if he sincerely felt that a lawyer in his court had violated the rules of professional conduct, he had an obligation to report that lawyer to what is now the Office of Lawyer Regulation and what used to be the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility. When that is done, that investigation remains confidential. What Judge Crawford did was he kept in his courtroom what you will see from the record, what has been called the book. The book was an exhibit in this case by the Judicial Commission. When he sent this memorandum to District Attorney McCann accusing Audrey Skarowski of having falsely filed a criminal complaint, he put a copy of that memo in his book and he invited the public in to look at it. He held this Assistant District Attorney, Audrey Skarowski, up to public ridicule, willfully, maliciously, and recklessly And that is what this case is all about. You asked, for example, about the, Justice Sykes, about the New York Times Sullivan test. There's a whole line of cases in the country, some of them are cited in our brief, that deal with disciplinary authorities dealing with speech issues when a lawyer ridicules or criticizes a judge. The majority of those cases, in analyzing the lawyer's conduct, whether the lawyer can be disciplined for criticizing a judge, the majority of those cases use a modified New York Times versus Sullivan standard or test, the two-prong test under the Times case. And those cases reason that for lawyers, for example, the protection of attorney criticism of judges is similar to the protection of criticism of other public officials, relying upon the principal purpose of the First Amendment, and that is to safeguard public discussion of governmental affairs. And we recognize that. But that speech by lawyers, and we submit by judges under the rules of professional conduct, can go too far. So when you do the New York Times analysis, you first decide whether the disciplinary authority, either in the case of the lawyer or in this case the Judicial Commission, has proven that the statement was a false statement of fact, number one, or, as these cases say, a statement of opinion that necessarily implies an undisclosed false assertion of fact. If you find that that is true, then you go to the second part of the test, and the second part of the test is, assuming that the statement is false, then the next question is whether the person, either the lawyer in those cases or here Judge Crawford, uttered that statement with actual or made the statement, whether it's oral statement or whether it's a written statement, with actual malice. That is, again, actual malice with knowledge that it was false or with reckless disregard as to its truth. And if you take just this one aspect of the facts in this case, the one finding on the Freddie Lewis matter, it fits perfectly into a New York Times Sullivan analysis as modified. Was false, that she filed, and there's a finding here by the conduct panel, that Ms. Skorowski did not file a complaint that she knew was false. Secondly, was that statement made by Judge Crawford with malice, with utter disregard for the truth? What is the evidence that goes to the maliciousness of his conduct? He puts it in a book in his courtroom and invites the people who are coming into his courtroom to look at it and say, look at what I said about the chief judge's daughter.
It's not measured by personal ill will, though, or that sort of it's measured by knowledge of the falsehood or reckless disregard as of the time that the statement is made, not what
which the judicial conduct panel found that Judge Crawford acted maliciously with knowledge that it was false, that he knew or should have known that what he was alleging was false.
And what is the evidence in the record that supports that factual finding? And I think we have to evaluate that on the basis of a clearly erroneous standard, because that's a finding of, well, no, that's a mixed question. Might probably be a mixed question of
without looking for and reading the particular finding by the judicial conduct panel. They go into a long explanation, Justice Sykes, of why their analysis showing that the Freddie Lewis matter was false and that Judge Crawford knew or should have known from listening to the evidence of his testimony when he testified about that issue that it in fact was false. I mean, he testified, for example, that he knew, at least it was his opinion, that she violated the rules of professional conduct. He knew he should have referred it to if that was true, he knew he had an obligation to refer it to the Board of Attorney's professional responsibility. I don't think he can look at it in a vacuum. I think you have to look at everything he testified to surrounding that issue. But there are other issues here besides that. That's not the sole issue as to making the false accusations. All of his accusations about influence peddling by the chief judge.
What is that, actually?
Well, that's a very good question, because during the course of these proceedings, that was asked many times. The Judicial Conduct Panel, it discusses this, and our position was that it was basically an accusation of misconduct in public office. Influence peddling implies to the public that a public official is accepting something in exchange for using his influence, illegally accepting something in exchange for using his influence. The accusations that he made, for example, about Audrey Skorowski authoring an anonymous letter that he received, and then destroying the letter after he received it, and alleging that in the petition to this court. There was, I think, the whole list of seven various allegations that he made in his petition. Each one was found by the Judicial Conduct Panel to be false and to have no basis whatsoever in fact, and they found that Judge Crawford willfully made those false statements about those people.
Mr. Basing, I'd like to have you comment on paragraph 47 of the findings of fact that Mr. Crawford spoke to in his remarks. That's the one about the Friday afternoons like perpetual state holidays.
The comment on it was that Judge Crawford did make that comment. There was testimony by the chief judge, by Judge Sullivan, by Judge Kahn, a number of Milwaukee County judges that in fact that, and by Bruce Harvey, that in fact that was not the case. If your question, Justice Prosser, is that in my opinion, does that fact, is that a fact that standing in and of itself could involve a violation of 60.03 paren 1. If that was all that Judge Crawford had said, that Circuit Judge Course judges in Milwaukee County have mini vacations during lunch and do not begin court on time and treat Friday afternoons like perpetual state holidays, if that's all we had, I would say no, I don't think we'd be here.
Well, to what extent does your case here depend upon some finding by this court on the extortion, criminal extortion statute?
The criminal extortion statute that's involved here was 940.30. That statute has not been visited recently by this court. It has been visited from time to time, but not recently. The importance of our allegations in that regard is this. 940.30 paren 1 and 940.34 are involved. We took the position, and the Judicial Conduct Panel agreed with us, that my notes on that, that at the January 13th, I believe it was, meeting, when, I think I have the right date, when Judge Crawford went to the meeting with Judge Skorowski that was attended by Judges Kahn and Sullivan, and he told the chief judge at that meeting, look, either you withdraw your order regulating my hours, or I am going to publicly accuse you of influence peddling and publicly attack your daughter, so to speak. What comes into play here is that statute, we believe, can be read as whoever verbally, because the statute uses that term verbally, maliciously threatens any injury to the profession or calling of another by attempting to influence the official action of any public official is guilty of a Class D felony. I've often been warned by judges that the use of analogies is not particularly good because they can backfire on you very quickly. I think an analogy perhaps to what occurred here would be that, let's say, a judge finds a lawyer in contempt of court and orders that lawyer to pay a $500 fine. And that lawyer then approaches the judge privately and says, "Look, Your Honor, either you withdraw the contempt finding or I will publicly expose you for having an affair with your neighbor's spouse." Is that extortion? I think it is. Isn't that what happened here? Isn't that what Judge Crawford did when he told Judge Skorowski, either you withdraw this order or I am publicly going to falsely, we allege, accuse you of influence peddling, of giving favors to people illegally in exchange for something, and I'm going to publicly accuse your daughter of unprofessional conduct, is really what he said. And if you don't withdraw your order, that's what I'm going to do. Judge Skorowski didn't withdraw his order, and that's what Judge Crawford, in fact, did.
Well, now, what does it mean to find that by, this is on pages 36 and 37 of the panels, it says, "Additionally, we have found clear and convincing evidence that Judge Crawford violated Section 943, 31, and 4. Now, those are criminal statutes.
Yes.
And if there was a, if we were going to deal with this as a crime, you'd have to find it. Obviously, there'd be a right to jury trial and stuff, but it would be beyond a reasonable doubt. So, is this just a shorthand for saying what you just said, or is it mean something else? That is, should the panel have said, "We found clear, convincing evidence that Judge Crawford," and then set forth the elements of this? Do you understand my question?
I think I understand your question, and I thought where you were going, Chief Justice, was to the issue of the fact that the judge was not prosecuted for extortion. So there is no finding that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and he hasn't had a chance to go to trial to say that. But I liken this I think the position of the Judicial Commission is that there is a criminal statute. We believe that Judge Crawford violated that statute. But we don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did that. We only have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he did that. And so it's unprosecuted activity within the boundaries of a judicial discipline case. And can that unprosecuted activity be used to discipline a judge when his conduct, in fact, clearly and convincingly violates that criminal statute?
And what code does it violate? What part, which of the SCRs does a violation of 943.31 and 4 constitute? Is it
60.031 is the integrity issue again, and I think a judge who
in all time and a manner promotes public confidence in the integrity and impartiality.
Right. It's not unlike a situation where a judge has engaged in gross personal misconduct but has not been prosecuted for it, but that gross personal misconduct forms then the basis of an action brought by the Judicial Commission to discipline that judge. And I think that's what we have here. And I you know, and in our brief, we pointed out that the prior cases under nine, under the criminal statute on extortion. Also, I think it was interesting in part of the record in this case, and maybe a law school evidentiary question as to asking one too many questions, but counsel for Judge Crawford was cross-examining Judge Sullivan, who was at the meeting where this conduct took place, and he asked this question on page 531 of the transcript. One last question, referring to the meeting on January 14th, 1999. At the time that that meeting was taking place, did you think that Judge Crawford was attempting to extort Chief Judge Skorowski? And Judge Sullivan said, yes.
Mr. Bastings, in the on page 16, final fact number 30, they quote the memorandum that, and I'm going to be asking the same question of Mr. Crawford, and I give Mr. Crawford a warning that it'll be coming at him. The memorandum says, Assistant District Attorney, this is the memorandum from Judge Crawford, Assistant District Attorney Audrey Skorowski drafted, signed, and filed a criminal complaint that she knew was materially false. Now, from the standpoint of the Judicial Commission, was there anything in that complaint that was materially false?
No.
That's a good answer.
Short answer.
So he was expressing his opinion because he sent along the transcript and court file are enclosed for your review. So that's part of it. Uh-huh.
He did enclose the transcript and the court file, but his statement was, again, that she drafted, signed, and filed a criminal complaint that she knew was materially false.
And there is nothing in that complaint that was materially false.
Our position was that there was nothing in that complaint that was materially false. The complaint set forth the stories of the people.
Right. And it was a complaint charging him with fourth-degree sexual assault, a misdemeanor, to which he pled.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Was there anything in the police report, though, and this is what I understand Judge Crawford's position to be, that there was something in the police report or the DA's file that demonstrated that the victim was lying, that the victim's statement was false, and so that to include it in the complaint would have been false, even though, you know, charging the case in the way that it was charged was okay?
You're testing my memory. My recollection is, Justice Sykes, that there was something in the police report where the detective was questioning the veracity of the complainant about what had initially occurred, the gunpoint abduction. But then as I think you also have to look at Audrey Skorowski's testimony during the course of this hearing, where she testified as to exactly what she did, why she did it, and what information she had that led to her drafting the complaint that she drafted. I think the signing is something else because it was also signed by a police officer.
Not to prolong this, but opposing counsel talked about this specifically and talked about the version, his version, and apparently there was a discussion with this detective. Is that part of the record, this discussion with the detective that said that the district attorney knew, or assistant district attorney knew about that this was skipping school, boyfriend, girlfriend, and was not as characterized? Hopefully I answered.
I don't. A discussion by the investigating officer with Audrey Skorowski?
No, with Judge Crawford. That's what I understand.
After the fact.
Correct.
There was some testimony, and that's all part of the record and part of the transcript, I think, that Judge Crawford sent to.
Sent to, and that's part of the transcript that is referred to on 16, paragraph 30.
I believe so. Yes, Justice.
A copy of that complaint
here?
Yes.
Is it in the record, or?
It may be here. There's several boxes of this.
It is. And the problem with this type of a case is that we don't have a clearly organized record, so I can't say it's record page such and such.
You don't have a copy of it with you, or?
I do not have a copy with me, no.
You do.
Mr. Basting, I've got a question in regard to the recommendation of the commission. It's my understanding that the panel made a recommendation for a one-year suspension. And my understanding is that it would appear, at least, that the Judicial Commission is now recommending removal. Will you tell us specifically what is being recommended, and if removal is being recommended, why?
I need to just back up a little bit, because I was expecting that question because of the position we took at the hearing in this matter, and it's I knew it because of the way I handled it in our brief. At the hearing, the Judicial Commission recommended to the conduct panel a one-year suspension. The conduct panel followed our recommendation and made the same recommendation to this court. After the decision of the conduct panel came down, the Judicial Commission met again and considered this matter, and the commission felt strongly that because of the finding by the commission of the felonious conduct, even though it was by clear and convincing evidence, that removal should have been and is now their recommendation.
If I could follow up on some of the questions that Justice Crooks and I were asking early on to clarify just what the heart of this case is. Is the commission suggesting that Judge Crawford should be disciplined for violating the order of both of the chief judges having to do with his work hours, or is the heart of this case really the petition and the statements made in the petition, together with the meeting that occurred where those same allegations were made?
The heart of this case has to do with what we have argued are the reckless, malicious, false accusations that he made about the people administering justice in Milwaukee County. That's what's at the heart of this case.
Thank you. Chief, may I just follow up on that? I am glad Justice Sykes asked that question, because I'm having a little difficulty. Normally, I would think I would see a finding of fact, and then that translates into a violation of 6003.1, and then another thing, and that's a violation of 6004.2. When asked about paragraph 47 of the findings, and this deals with the behavior of those in administration in the court system, Justice Prosser asked you about 47, which is the mini-vacations and the Friday afternoon stuff. You said, well, that in and of itself wouldn't be a violation of anything. Tell me, if you would, which of these, and it looks like they're primarily in paragraphs 46 through 50.
Starting with 46.
Okay, 46 through 53.
Yes.
Which ones are violations or combinations constitute a violation of a code provision, so that I can look to it and say, oh, they're alleging here a violation, so that we can, so that they want this activity disciplined pursuant to this code provision?
As we alleged, and as the Judicial Conduct Panel found, Justice Bradley, that the totality of the conduct of making these false accusations, which are found in findings 46 through 53, violated 60.03 paren 1 of the Code of Judicial Conduct. And I think you have to take all of them, as the Judicial Conduct Panel did, into consideration as a whole. And that's what I think
46, for, I mean, I don't want to...
What about 60.04 sub 2? They said that was also violated. So I want to know what constitutes that violation. I'm looking at page 35, appendix 35, where they indicate that his conduct also shows a failure to cooperate with court officials in the administration of court business, SCR 60.04 sub 2. So it looks to me like it's not only the criminal statute cited, but 60.03 sub 1 and 60.04 sub 2, which are the basis of the rules that we're supposed to address.
60.04 sub 2 deals with the violation by Judge Crawford of the Sheedy and Skorowski order. And that's a separate finding that the judicial conduct panel made. They said he violated that order because, and then they, in many of their findings, you will find that the judicial conduct panel cited instances where he did not cooperate with Judge Skorowski in his order limiting his hours. And so that particular rule of judicial conduct goes to that issue alone. The criminal issue, the extortion issue, and the rest of the false accusations all fit under 60.03 paren 1, which has to do with acting in a manner that promotes public confidence in the integrity and impartiality of the judiciary.
Is there any significance to the fact that that particular part of the code utilizes the word should instead of shall, indicating an aspirational goal rather than a mandatory duty?
I don't believe so. I believe it's a rule that applies to judges, and that if a judge makes a false, reckless, malicious allegation that is untrue and holds somebody up to public ridicule.
I'm talking about the other one, the 60.04 sub 2 area, the one having to do with the work order.
Yes.
And you said that, you know, there's two parts of this case.
Right.
You consider one to be more serious than the other.
Yes.
But that particular part of the case is phrased in terms of should. A judge should do this as opposed to a judge shall. And generally, under the code, that has a distinction in that one is a mandatory duty and the other is an aspirational goal. Would you agree with that?
I don't disagree with that by the use of the word should, but I'm having a hard time. I mean, the rules of this court and reading that, I think if a chief judge gives an order to a circuit court judge and says, and it's a legitimate order, which we claim it was here, that a willful violation of that order by the chief judge violates that section of the judicial code.
Well, that may fall under the first part. A judge shall diligently discharge the judge's administrative responsibilities without bias or prejudice, and shall maintain professional confidence in judicial administration. Justice Sykes is looking at the second part, which says
the cooperate
should cooperate. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
One final thing for me, anyway. As you may know, and I know you do know, that the court is looking at the rules of campaign content. Had a Fairchild report and recommendation from the Fairchild report. One of the recommendations, it deals with campaign rhetoric, and part of it says campaign rhetoric concerning court rules or administrative practices and policies should not be restricted. Now that's the recommendation. If Judge Crawford said all of these things regarding administrative practices and policies in the context of a campaign, would that make either his or one involving Judge Skorowski, would that make any difference?
I don't believe that fits into what happened in this case, because I don't see how accusing an assistant district attorney, for example, of unprofessional conduct, if there's no basis to do that, could ever fit into campaign rhetoric. The issue here, broadly stated, is how far will this court permit a judge to go in making false accusations about public officials, in this case, in the judicial administration system? How far can that judge go? Our position here is that he went way, way beyond the bounds of any sort of campaign rhetoric or fair comment when he began to falsely accuse people of engaging in improper, unprofessional conduct or criminal activity.
Thank you, Mr. Basting. Mr. Crawford, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. Justice Abramson. Let me correct one mistake of fact that's permeated the judicial findings. What Judge Crawford has is in his courtroom is a series of three-ring binders in which he collects all of his written opinions on sentencing, motions to dismiss, motions to suppress evidence, and they're organized by subject matter. And it's a reading file, which allows all the lawyers who are waiting for their cases to come up to read about all of the past cases, decisions that have been rendered by this judge, who is fairly prolific at writing opinions at the circuit court level. When the judge was charged with discipline, and he waived his right for privacy, and the Judicial Council or Judicial Commission went public with their complaint, Judge Crawford filed an answer and a motion to dismiss that complaint. That's when he put the pleadings on the file. I don't know why the significance here is so great that this point should be, that you should be misled about this. Because the judicial discipline is public. Its files are public records when they go public with their public prosecution. Everything in this courtroom is a public record. And none of you are responsible for the embarrassment that anybody who is caught in the vortex of a public debate happens to incur as part of a public displeasure. Judge Crawford is not guilty of anything, not even a discourtesy, in having to defend himself and making a courtesy copy available in his courtroom as part of his defense to the accusations. Secondly, the rat rule. The rat rule, as they call it at the ethics seminars, I didn't make this up, is that we have a duty to report each other when we think someone's violated a code of conduct. The judicial panel doesn't say Judge Crawford violated any law or should be removed from the bench, but it does accuse him of violating the rat rule by not referring the complaint about judicial misconduct to the Board of Professional Responsibility instead of referring it to Mike McCann, the boss. You can't have it both ways. If Judge Crawford was wrong and it wasn't an ethical violation, then it seems to me discussion of the rat rule is completely useless in this case.
Mr. Crawford, can I draw your attention to the same question that I asked Mr. Basting, and that is the memorandum that Judge Crawford sent to District Attorney Michael McCann and said that Attorney Skrosky drafted, signed, and filed a criminal complaint that she knew was materially false.
Yes.
What was materially false in that complaint that she knew about?
This is in volume two of Judge Crawford's pleadings filed in response, asking for dismissal of the complaint, which was then turned into motion for summary judgment, which he lost. It is volume two, bait stamp page 5,253, It is the criminal complaint in the Freddie Lewis case. And I will read you from the first paragraph, which is all a lie, every word of this. Selma Woods indicated that the defendant put a gun to her neck and said, quote, "If you don't get in the car, I'll kill you," end quote. Mrs. Woods tried to run away, but Lewis grabbed her by the arm and pulled her into the car. He took her to his residence at 334 West Hadley Street in the city and county of Milwaukee, state of Wisconsin, where he went in through the front door and went into his bedroom.
But Mr. Crawford, isn't it clear from reading that complaint that what Audrey Skrowski is doing is quoting from Selina's own statement?
Well, let's go then to the story.
She's not claiming that herself, is she? As I understand it, she put into the complaint Selina Lewis's statement and Freddie Lewis's statement.
Both her explanation, Justice Babich, yes.
Well, isn't that made clear in the complaint? And isn't it also made clear in the complaint that the detective at the end indicated that he did not believe Selina? These statements that you were just reading?
Yes, the statement that I was about to read, which is the detective's testimony at the sentencing proceeding, says that he thought that the assistant attorney general was not going to proceed with the case. When he received a subpoena later on, it was a total surprise to him that she was proceeding with any prosecution in the case. And if you read the transcripts prior to that, when Judge Crawford was getting ready to sentence, and he asked the prosecutor who was assigned to the case at the time in court, they thought that those statements in the complaint were true. So if you read the transcript, even the prosecutors who were subsequently prosecuting the case believed those facts to be true, and it's only after the lunch hour break that the information came back, we were giving you the full story or something to that effect in that complaint. I assure you, Judge, it is not common practice in Milwaukee County to draft complaints where you include statements of defendants or witnesses that you know are lies. That is not common practice, and it shouldn't be condoned.
But in the complaint, and I don't have it in front of me, I guess I'm going to ask if we can have that.
It's in the record, isn't it?
It's in the record.
Okay, we'll find it. It clearly indicates that is the statement of Selina, doesn't it? And doesn't it clearly indicate also that the contrary facts are the statement of Freddie Lewis? I've got to be in charge with this statement. In paragraph 28, the panel says, no reasonable judge would consider Audrey Skrowski's actions in the Freddie Lewis case to be unprofessional or inept. That's in paragraph 28 of the panel's findings.
And they're wrong on that. Certainly, if you read the transcript, the district attorney didn't see everything as clearly as is now being seen. Judge Crawford didn't see it as clearly at the time, and you can say he's not smart enough or he should have had a more clairvoyance, and yes, he should have had more clairvoyance, but the fact of the matter is there was a serious ambiguity, and it was misleading, and the judge was not going to sentence somebody for a fourth degree misdemeanor, which I believe was the 10 days served, if in fact that violent conduct had occurred. And you have to remember, a misdemeanor court judge, there's no pre-sentence report. You have to interview the players in order to find out what happened, and as you go through the sentencing process. And Judge Crawford did that here and was shocked at what he came up with as a relatively insignificant case of teenage sex, consensual, completely consensual.
Crawford, your red light is on. If you would sum up in a couple of sentences, we'd appreciate that.
The decision tree that the court should follow, and the reason that I have not attempted to mud wrestle with many of these facts and opinions and the gray areas in between the facts and opinions, is because if we put the entire petition and the events surrounding it on the table as a pile of manure, what we have is a principle of constitutional law that says that it really doesn't matter what was said. It was a subjective opinion. This is a political debate. When people come into public office, whether it's as district attorneys or as judges, they have thick skins, and they'd better have thick skins when things that they do professionally that involve the public trust are subject to debate. Under Article 1, Section 4, this complaint should be dismissed because the right to petition government for grievances, which is the quintessential four corners of exactly what Judge Crawford's being prosecuted for, is absolute. It is not conditional as the right to petition government under the First Amendment is, according to the United States Supreme Court in the McDonald case. Secondly, the right to petition government and have opinions about the fitness or unfitness of public office holders is also absolutely protected under both of the right to petition and the First Amendment. And it certainly should be for elected judges under the Wisconsin Constitution. Finally, you can't criminalize speech such as Judge Crawford utilized to say, if you do not give me what I believe is mine by right, I will go public and you will be embarrassed. And that is the essence of this. And that is subject to the right of public debate under the First Amendment. Finally, this panel's discussion did not even hint at any balancing or analysis of the subjective actual malice standard when it brushed aside the First Amendment issues that it saw. And so you cannot, and we ask that you therefore dismiss the complaint on the basis of those constitutional grounds, which really supersede and override all of the nitpicking about what some of the opinions were and how well-founded they were or were not.
Question?
Yes, sir.
Your closing statement just prompted another question. You said that they didn't even hint at maliciousness. The brief of the Judicial Commission on page 8 suggests otherwise. And this, I take it that this quote is directly from the panel findings. Judge Crawford's threats were malicious and not based upon any truthful allegations.
Well, maliciousness, as we pointed out in our brief, suggests ill will, an evil, I don't like you, I think you're a knave type of response. The constitutional standard of actual malice, now that's a term of art, it's a term of extreme art. It doesn't mean the type of malice that you would find in other sorts of cases where ill will is in fact being tested. And we provide this breathing room, this extra level of protection, in the First Amendment, because otherwise we would stifle and chill all debate. So I don't believe, Justice Babbage, that the use of the word malice in that context has the all-important First Amendment gloss that it does under New York Times versus Sullivan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Thank you to all the counsel. All the cases the court hears, difficult, especially discipline cases of lawyers and judges, and as you all know, the court is familiar with the Milwaukee County Circuit Court and the people involved in this one. So with that said, I will close the hearing on 00-0640-J. This proceeding is an end. Court will meet in the conference room forthwith, and if the lawyers will approach the bench.